Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in Review. But first, we present There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, a program presented and produced by Jill Bevilacqua.
The tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering around Jesus to hear him, at which the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then he addressed this parable to them. A man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the estate that is coming to me." So the father divided up the property. Some days later, this younger son collected all his belongings and went off to a distant land, where he squandered his money on dissolute living. After he had spent everything, a great famine broke out in that country, and he was in dire need. So he attached himself to one of the propertied class of the place, who sent him to his farm to take care of the pigs. He longed to fill his belly with the husks that were fodder for the pigs, but no one made a move to give him anything. Coming to his senses at last, he said, "How many hired hands at my father's place have more than enough to eat, while here am I, starving? I will break away and return to my father, and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against God and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.'" With that he set off for his father's house. While he was still a long way off, his father caught sight of him and was deeply moved. He ran out to meet him, threw his arms around his neck, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against God and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son." The father said to his servants, "Quick, bring out the finest robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet. Take the fatted calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate, because this son of mine was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and is found." Then the celebration began. Meanwhile, the elder son was out on the land. As he neared the house on his way home, he heard the sound of music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked him the reason for the dancing and the music. The servant answered, "Your brother is home, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back again in good health." The son grew angry at this and would not go in. But his father came out and began to plead with him. He said in reply to his father, "For years now I've slaved for you. I never disobeyed one of your orders. Yet you never gave me so much as a kid goat to celebrate with my friends. Then when this son of yours returns after having gone through your property with loose women, you kill the fatted calf for him?" "My son," replied the father, "you're with me always, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice. This brother of yours was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and is found."
Is there any other parable which has had such a press as that of the prodigal son? So often quoted, so variously interpreted, some emphasizing the role of the father, some that of the elder brother. And the prodigal? He needs no emphasis. His story is universal. In different ways, to a greater or lesser extent, the parable has relevance to each and every age and condition. It will never become out of date. But why do we call it the parable of the prodigal son? The word prodigal doesn't appear in any of the English versions I've looked at. Who first gave it that title, I wonder, and why? Back to the roots first. The Latin lexicographer Festus, in the 2nd century, says that the Romans called victims wholly consumed by fire prodigae hostiae, meaning wasted victims. Presumably, he was talking about sacrificial victims. And he adds that those who waste their substance are therefore called prodigals. Brewer discounts this explanation and writes, "The word ultimately goes back to the Latin pro digere, meaning to squander, or literally to drive forth, from pro meaning forth and agere to drive. The notion was that persons who had spent all their patrimony were driven forth to be sold as slaves to their creditors." The dictionaries seem to agree on the meaning of prodigal as wasteful, even recklessly wasteful, given to extravagant expenditure, lavish in the bestowal or disposal of things, was a 1596 definition, and a modern dictionary defines a prodigal as anyone who spends or gives lavishly and foolishly. It adds, prodigal son, a repentant sinner or reformed spendthrift. This is what is generally understood by the word, and almost always with reference to money. The nobility is prodigal in expenses, spending more than their revenues in diet and apparel. This was a quotation of 1601, but no source was given. Another quote of 1864 runs, "Nature is prodigal of human life." There is also a positive meaning, yielding abundantly. Today's dictionary suggests lavish of new ideas, and an older volume refers to May, prodigal of flowers. Which reminds me of a delightful incident recounted in her garden book by Vita Sackville-West. It's spring, and she's been out in the country driving past orchards lovely with apple and cherry blossom.
"I came home expecting no further delight that day, but on arrival I saw a closed van at the front door. A smiling young man confronted me, saying he did not know if I would be interested in these, and opened the van as he spoke. These were giant pansies, thousands and thousands of them. The van's dark interior was a cavern of colour. Some royal hand had flung rugs of velvet over the stacks of wooden trays. Purples were there, and subtler colours than purple, bronze and greenish-yellow and claret and rose-red, all in their queer cat faces of crumpled velvet. I stood amazed."
And she ends with a practical gardener's suggestion.
"As for those whose houses do not lie on his road, a packet of seed should serve the purpose, and by next spring the ground should appear as though spread with the most sumptuous carpet from Isfahan."
The most telling of modern definitions refers to a prodigal son or daughter, a person who leaves home to lead a prodigal life but returns repentant, with allusion to the parable in Luke. So well known is the parable that no explanation is added. But the departure of a son or daughter to lead a prodigal life is not perhaps the most common reason for a young person to leave home. A dash for freedom from parental control or a yearning for independence is more usual. And anyway, how many parents today have an estate to share among their children? As for a repentant return, it's not always the case. Far more likely, the money has run out. It happened to my younger son, who said he'd like to try living on his own. "Fine, go ahead," we said. So off he went. 2 years later, he was back. "They've put the rent up," he sighed. But this was only a local departure. Our parable is on a much more drastic scale. And in his poem, Departure of the Prodigal Son, Rainer Maria Rilke questions such a decision.
To depart, whither? To unrevealing distance, to some warm, unrelated land, that back clothwise will stay without all feeling beyond all action, garden, sea, or sand. And to depart, why? Impulse, generation, impatience, obscure hope and desperation not to be understood or understand. To take on all this and in vain persistence, let fall perhaps what you have held, to die alone and destitute, not knowing why. Is this the way into some new existence?
But there is something in the quality of prodigality that belongs peculiarly to youth. Life is prodigal in its gifts to the young, abundance of health and vigour, and of course, abundance of time. And youth is prodigal in its use of those and other gifts. In a poem about the celandine, Wordsworth ends with a reflection on this. He has seen the flower in its youth, shrinking from cold and rain. Now it is old, it stands forth, an offering to the blast, not from choice, but from necessity.
The sunshine may not cheer it, nor the dew. It cannot help itself in its decay. To be a prodigal's favourite, then, worse truth, a miser's pensioner, behold our lot. O man, that from thy fair and shining youth age might but take the things youth needed not.
And Shakespeare reminds us how the young lover is lavish in his promises. When the blood burns, how prodigal the soul lends the tongue vows. Certainly the younger son in the parable had the fire in the blood, proper to youth, and rushed on his ruin, living riotously. He had never been in need, so could not imagine what it was like until it happened to him. Life at home had been comfortable but not exciting, and he no doubt had to work on the land like his brother. But with money in his pocket, why wait? Give me my share now. And a vision of unending pleasure rises up before him. Perhaps something like the illusory world Scott Fitzgerald wrote of in The Great Gatsby. America in the 1920s, jazz age New York, brightly lit playground of irresponsible millionaires, as one critic put it.
There was music from my neighbor's house through the summer nights. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne and the stars. On buffet tables, garnished with glistening hors d'oeuvre, spiced baked hams crowded against salads of harlequin designs and pastry pigs and turkeys bewitched to a dark gold. By 7 o'clock, the cars from New York are parked 5 deep in the drive, and already the halls and salons and verandas are gaudy with primary colours. The bar is in full swing, and floating rounds of cocktails permeate the garden outside, until the air is alive with chatter and laughter, and casual innuendo and introductions forgotten on the spot. The lights grow brighter as the earth lurches away from the sun, and now the orchestra is playing yellow cocktail music, and the opera of voices pitches a key higher. Laughter is easier, minute by minute, spilled with prodigality.
But the beautiful bubble bursts and reality strikes at last. And our hero finds himself not only penniless, but starving. And the ultimate ignominy, looking after pigs, which for a Jew were unclean animals. And he would willingly have filled his belly with the husks the pigs were eating. In the Italian, the word carubo is used for the husks, pods of the carob bean, in Greek keration. Carob beans were also used as a unit of weight, and from this comes our word carat, for the measure of the purity of gold in an alloy. Precious husks indeed. As for the pigs, we usually think of them as munching acorns, as in these lines from Pigs in the Wood by Robert Bloomfield, a late 18th century writer.
No more the fields with scattered grain supply the restless wandering tenants of the sty. From oak to oak they run with eager haste, and wrangling share the first delicious taste of fallen acorns, yet but thinly found, till the strong gale have shook them to the ground. It comes, and roaring woods obedient wave. Their home well pleased, the joint adventurers leave. The trudging sow leads forth her numerous young, playful and white and clean the briars among. And o'er their heads, loud lashed by furious squalls, bright from their cups the rattling treasure falls.
When the foreign country he's wasted his substance in is struck by famine, the young prodigal finds no one willing to offer him food, not even the carob beans. For although normally given to the pigs as fodder, they were eaten by humans in time of famine. His situation is desperate. His fair-weather friends have melted away, Now he's a pauper, and he doesn't seem to have made any real ones. With a famine raging, moreover, it's every man for himself. So now, the illusory world he has lived in, a fast-fading memory, and a bitter one at that, he thinks of the men who work for his father, who have more than enough to eat, while he is starving. "I will arise and go to my father," ran the old version, and we know the rest. And now the real hero makes his appearance. At the beginning, all we're told of the father is that he divides the property. We may only imagine his feelings as he watches his younger son leave without so much as a glance behind. But he never loses hope, and is out there, one imagines, almost daily, looking into the distance. And when he sees him, still far off, he runs to meet him, falls on his neck and kisses him. This gospel is called by our liturgist a great hymn in praise of God the Father's merciful love. And a Bible scholar points out that this chapter of Luke is illumined by the phrase spoken by the scribes and Pharisees. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.
The theme of the merciful and generous love of God who pardons is illustrated in a stupendous triptych of parables: the lost sheep, the lost drachma, the prodigal son. The stories have their climax not in the losing, but in the finding. Joy, celebration, happiness. Contrary to its traditional title, the third parable has as protagonist not so much the son prodigal of sin and betrayal, as the father prodigal of love.
After the son has confessed his fault, come the celebrated words to the servants to bring out the finest robe and put it on him, the ring for his finger, sign of authority.
The ring is probably one with the family seal. To put the ring on his finger then means to re-establish the dignity of the son and acknowledge his authority over the property and the servants. The shoes, or sandals, represent the dress of the free man compared to the slave.
Most quoted phrase of all is the order to kill the fatted calf, still used today when we want to celebrate a person, to welcome with the best of everything, as one definition has it. And the third member of the family? He is furious when the servants tell him the reason for the music and dancing and refuses to enter the house. This self-righteous behaviour of the son, who has slaved for the father for years and never disobeyed, is a reflection, writes a scholar, of the behaviour of the Pharisees, who murmured against Jesus and his generosity towards sinners. The reasoning of the elder brother is that of reasonable and limited human justice, writes Piero Bargellini. His objections are those of the Pharisees. But the way the father justifies the celebration puts a different complexion on the matter.
From sorrow for a death and joy for a return to life, there is no place for reasonings, trials, distinctions and refinements. There's room only for unlimited joy, which should be shared by all.
Suffering is not divine retribution. On the contrary, it is intended for a good purpose, so that the works of God may be displayed.
And our thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for bringing us yet another There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Meanwhile, time to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. She brings us the Vatican Week in review. Joan, welcome back. Very exciting week.
And no date for the conclave as we record.
Exactly. Always an exciting week because you just don't know what's coming up. There's no calendar as there usually is. There's a rhythm we follow, and that rhythm, you know, has obviously been shattered for the resignation of Benedict XVI, Pope Emeritus. But life is going on as it should for a conclave, in the sense that, as we speak, all 115 cardinal electors are in Rome. The last one was a cardinal from Vietnam, and he arrived Thursday afternoon. It's my understanding, Father Lombardi said, that two Vietnamese priests from Vatican Radio went to the airport to pick him up. So the electors are here. They join with all the other cardinals, non-electors, that is to say over the age of 80, and discuss a lot of church business. So the cardinals, electors and not, have been holding their congregation since Monday morning, March the 4th. And they met Monday morning and afternoon, Tuesday and Wednesday only in the morning, and Thursday two congregations scheduled for Friday. We're in the midst of a congregation as we speak. But Wednesday afternoon, while there was no congregation, there was a very beautiful prayer service, the Glorious Mysteries of the Rosary, Eucharistic Adoration in St. Peter's Basilica.
At the altar of the chair.
Oh, exactly. The importance, the chair of Peter, and the cardinals are gathering here in Rome to eventually go into the conclave to elect the successor of St. Peter. And the chair has a very wonderful, beautiful history attributed, they thought, for many, many years. The chair that's encased in a bronze bigger chair created by Bernini, said to have been a chair that Peter sat on when he came to Rome. It was a very moving ceremony, and the interesting thing is the cardinals have highlighted the need for prayers. They ask people to pray for them as they are meeting in these important days to select a new pontiff. And so here was this prayer service, and the faithful could join, which is very, very nice. So the faithful could be there alongside the cardinals, one of whom may very well in coming weeks be wearing white. I did hear a comment this morning about we already have the new pope. He's in a room with the other cardinals wearing a red hat right now.
And of course, the white vestments are already prepared, have already been
Gamarelli,
sewn and in the window, apparently.
Well, and the interesting thing is they make it so that there are three sizes, and we have all sizes in the College of Cardinals, from short to tall, from fairly good girth to very,
small,
very
medium, large,
to very slender. And the interesting thing is that even on a large, someone who's tall and has certain girth, they have made that so it can be very quickly either let out or taken in, or even the hem changed, because you don't want it to be knee length when it goes on the wearer. So the vestments are ready. They're getting the Sistine Chapel ready. DTV, the Vatican Television, has provided the media as they get their briefing every day from Father Lombardi. The Vatican Television has provided the media with footage, 2 days in a row of footage of the work done, all the equipment first being brought in and then the actual work being done in the Sistine Chapel. They put a protective coating on that beautiful floor. If they didn't have that coating, you'd have chairs being moved, you'd have tables, you'd have people walking. So the protective coating, then they do raise the floor. I'm not sure of the exact height, how much they raise it, to correspond with one of the steps goes up at the end of the chapel to the altar, so that there aren't that many steps when the cardinals have to go to the table. There will be on the right and left long sides of the chapel the tables where the cardinals will sit and vote, and two tiers of those. Then at the far end of the room will be the cardinals, the scrutineers, I believe they are called, who will take the ballots, so that the cardinals, when they do walk up with their vote and have to place it in one of three urns, one of the urns is for the sick, that has a special lock on it. And when the cardinals go up, they're not going to have to climb a lot of steps. And then they are going to put a protective, a kind of a shield will be in the ceiling area of the chapel. That particular shield is going to prevent any communications from going into or coming out of the Sistine Chapel and the conclave itself. And then any and all windows and doors leading to the area that have panes of glass, those are covered with an opaque shield, if you will, too, so that people cannot see in. At the end of the footage yesterday, they did show the Papal Gardens, like the very big sloping garden area in front of the Governorate Palace.
Behind
St. Peter's Basilica. Very big, broad, sloping hill on which, in flowers and shrubs, you have the papal coat of arms. Mm-hmm. And they have taken out Benedict's, and they will be ready to plant flowers for a new papal coat of arms, because that's the whole interesting thing. You have a new pope. We're going to know who he is as Cardinal so-and-so when the conclave ends. But then they have to take a name, and that's always fascinating. And how they do that is, I mean, if you look at papal names, you look at Leo or Clement or John Paul. We've only had two of them. We've had 16 Benedicts and so forth. Lots of interesting things. A pope will have his crest there. And there is a specific coat of arms crest for the Sede Vacante. It still has the crossed silver and gold keys indicating earthly and heavenly power. And then instead of the triple tiara signifying the three duties of a pontiff or of any bishop for that matter, there's kind of an umbrella over the keys. And this is the sede vacante. It's only used in that time. And when coins are made, as they're in the process of being made, and stamps, they have that coat of arms instead of the papal coat of arms. An interesting video for Friday's press conference is Santa Marta. The Domus Sanctae Martae is the St. Martha residence in the Vatican, where they will move in only on the eve of the conclave. The cardinals now are in various residences all over Rome. And Father Lombardi, who gives briefings every day, has two assistants who translate into English and Spanish when needed. He gives information, then he answers questions from the media. And these can go on for, on average, probably 90 minutes. They're amazing conferences, and begin at about 1 o'clock. But Father told us yesterday, in answer to one question about why he couldn't give names or certain details of speeches, the cardinals get up in congregations and they give brief talks. And Father said he has taken the same vow to obey the congregation rules of secrecy and silence as the cardinals have, or any other staff member. Those people working, for example, on the Santa Marta residence, any of the maids and people who work in the kitchen, they also have to ascribe to this vow of secrecy. And Father is being allowed in. It's the, I believe he said it was the Dean of the College of Cardinals who had said, yes, you should be here, can be here, because that way you can give better information. But he is limited. He cannot give the names of, let's say, 14 cardinals who spoke in a morning session, nor can he give excerpts specifically of what they talked about. So you're not going to have a good picture of a cardinal from a certain continent talking about XYZ issue. And so he said the topics discussed are the new evangelization, the Holy See and the world, the Roman Curia, the need for reorganization, the relationship to bishops, the ecumenical dialogue, interreligious and ecumenical dialogue. And then, this is so interesting, the cardinals are putting together, as they get up and talk and say what they need in a new Holy Father, they're putting together a profile of the Holy Father. But just humanly, you think of Benedict. This is somehow going to, just as Benedict, notwithstanding his humility, just normal human curiosity would probably lead you to wonder what the profile is. And pretty soon, when a new pope was elected, I think you'll see that profile perhaps reflected in the new pope. So, and who knows, where are we going to be talking about a new pope when I come back to this spot next week? It'll be interesting to see.
Yes. Yes. I hope so.
I hope so, too.
Thank you very much, Joan.
Bless.
And you were listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, while we won't be back again at the same time tomorrow, we will be back again at the same time next weekend. So be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.